Imagine a story where a deeply corrupt, embezzling politician who steals from his own community is framed as the ultimate hero.
Oh, wow.
Right? And then a devoted, selfless charity worker who gives away literally everything is framed as the absolute villain.
Yeah. I mean, if you heard a story like that today, you would probably be pretty offended.
Oh, totally. The moral compass of the whole narrative would just feel entirely broken. But, well, 2,000 years ago, Jesus told exactly that kind of story, and it completely scandalized everyone in the room.
It really did.
So welcome to today's deep dive. We have a really fascinating stack of research sitting here in front of us today, a rigorous historical and linguistic analysis of the original Greek and the first century cultural context surrounding the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector.
Which is found in the Gospel of Luke, right? Chapter 18.
Exactly.
And, you know, for anyone walking out their faith in the modern world, this specific parable is usually treated as this very simple, almost dusty morality tale.
Yeah, like a children's book.
Right. The standard Sunday school takeaway is typically reduced to, you know, don't be arrogant like the Pharisee, just be humble like the tax collector.
Just use good manners, basically.
Which is a nice sentiment, sure. But our sources today reveal that by framing it as a simple lesson in manners, we are completely missing the theological explosion that Jesus intentionally set off.
And that is the core of our mission for you today. Jesus wasn't just offering a polite tip on having a humble attitude. He was dropping absolute dynamite that dismantled the entire religious merit system of his day.
Oh, completely.
We are going to decode these hidden linguistic and cultural meanings from the first century, and we want to see how this ancient shocker directly challenges and reshapes your walk in faith right now. So, okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah, to truly grasp the punchline of this parable, we first have to understand the initial setup.
Right.
That requires stepping out of our modern psychological framework and stepping into the highly pressurized, occupied world of a first century Jewish listener.
Because right off the bat, we run into a massive historical misconception.
Huge misconception.
When you or I hear the word Pharisee today, our brains immediately autofill the word hypocrite. Like, the cultural programming is so strong that you hear Pharisee,
mm-hmm.
and you instinctively know, oh, they're the bad guy of the story.
Right. They're the antagonists in almost every film adaptation of the Gospels.
Exactly. But looking at the sources, that is entirely a product of reading history backwards, isn't it?
It really is. To a first century Jewish audience, that couldn't be further from the truth. The Pharisee was the unquestioned cultural hero. You have to understand the context of Roman occupation. The Jewish people were living under the crushing boot of an empire that demanded absolute submission.
Right. Pay your taxes, worship Caesar, all that.
Exactly. And many groups compromised. But the Pharisees, they were the grassroots resistance.
The resistance. I love that frame.
Right. But not with swords. They resisted with radical obedience to the Torah.
So they were essentially the cultural glue trying to keep the identity of the people intact against this this massive threat of assimilation.
Precisely. They were the most rigorously devoted, deeply respected religious leaders of their day. They actually believed that if Israel could achieve perfect purity, God would intervene and liberate them from Rome.
So if you wanted an example of a good, upstanding, desperately faithful person in that culture, you pointed straight to a Pharisee.
You did. And then on the flip side of this cultural spectrum, you have the tax collector or the publican.
And we really need to clarify this because looking at the research, this wasn't just a grumpy bureaucrat working for an ancient IRS.
No, not even close. The tax collector was the ultimate villain. And for very visceral reasons.
Right.
These were Jewish citizens who had actively chosen to collaborate with the oppressive Roman Empire.
They switched sides.
They totally did. Rome would essentially franchise out tax collection. A local citizen would bid for the contract, and Rome would say, give us this much money. Whatever you collect on top of that, you keep.
Wow. So they were heavily incentivized by the state to extort their own neighbors.
They absolutely were. They padded their own pockets by shaking down their own people, and it was all backed by the threat of Roman military violence.
That is just brutal.
Because of this, they were considered ceremonially unclean. They were barred from worshiping in the synagogue. In fact, in the rabbinic legal texts of the day, tax collectors were actually classified in the exact same legal category as robbers and murderers.
Wait, really? The same legal category?
Yes. Their testimony wasn't even valid in a Jewish court.
Okay, that brings the charity worker versus corrupt politician analogy into really sharp focus. When Jesus started this story, the original audience was fully bracing themselves to cheer for the Pharisee and violently boo the tax collector. Setting the story up this way and then flipping the script, I mean, that would have deeply offended the religious sensibilities of the original listeners.
But that friction is the architectural genius of the trap. Jesus leverages their absolute certainty about who the good guy is just to pull the rug out from under their entire understanding of how God measures righteousness.
That is amazing. Well, let's look at how this Pharisee actually views his own faith, because the sources point out some incredible details in his prayer.
Yeah, let's look at it.
According to the text, the Pharisee goes up to the temple, stands by himself, and prays, you know, I fast twice a week, I give tithes of all that I possess. Now, I want to push back on the traditional reading of this for a second.
Okay, go for it.
As a modern believer reading the text, spiritual discipline is universally taught as a positive thing, right? The man isn't lying to God. He is objectively living a highly disciplined moral life. So why is this framed as a negative?
Well, to understand the fatal flaw in his theology, you have to look at the mathematics of his discipline.
Mathematics?
Yeah. Our sources highlight just how extreme his practices were compared to the baseline of what God actually required in the Torah.
Okay, lay it out for me.
Let's take fasting. The Mosaic Law only required the Jewish people to fast one single day out of the entire year on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement.
Wait, just one day? But this Pharisee says he is fasting twice a week. That's, what, 104 times a year?
Exactly. He is fasting over 100 times more than God commanded. And it's the exact same dynamic with his money. The law required tithing on your primary income and your main agricultural crops. But the Pharisee specifically says he tithes on everything he acquires.
Everything.
Historically, we know the most zealous Pharisees would go out into their small gardens and meticulously count out the tiny individual leaves of mint, dill, and cumin.
You're kidding. Counting mint leaves.
Just to make sure they gave exactly 1/10 of a garden herb to God.
I mean, it is the ultimate extra credit spiritual resume.
Yeah.
But that still leaves the question, like, what is the psychological engine driving that level of obsession?
The engine is a transactional view of faith. He isn't fasting out of a posture of brokenness or humility. He is building a ledger.
A ledger.
He genuinely believes that his spiritual extra credit puts the creator of the universe in his debt. By presenting this flawless resume, he is essentially saying, look at my performance, God. I have achieved a level of purity that legally obligates you to bless me.
Wow.
Yeah.
That completely changes how you read his prayer.
And what's fascinating here is how this transactional mindset inevitably poisons his view of the people around him. Luke opens the story by noting that Jesus told this parable to those who, quote, trusted in themselves that they were righteous and viewed others with contempt.
I was looking at that in the notes. Our research dives into the original Greek word used for contempt there.
Mm-hmm.
The word is exithenio. But I'm struggling to understand the mechanical connection there. How does building a spiritual resume automatically lead to exithenio? What does that word actually mean in practice?
It's a really powerful compound word that literally translates to count as nothing or to make a zero out of someone.
Make a zero out of someone. Man.
When your entire standing before God is based on your own performance, you subconsciously need other people to perform worse than you. Your righteousness becomes entirely relative.
Right, because if everyone is getting an A+, your extra credit doesn't make you special anymore.
Exactly. The Pharisee needs the tax collector to be a zero, so that by comparison, he can be a 10.
That is a chilling diagnostic of the human heart. And honestly, it translates so seamlessly to our walk in faith today.
It really does.
Like, the insidious trap of modern self-righteousness isn't usually overt malice. We rarely walk into a church building actively despising people.
Right, it's a lot more subtle.
Yeah. But we absolutely fall into the trap of validating our own spiritual standing by subconsciously reducing others to a zero. We tell ourselves, I might struggle with my temper, but at least I serve on the worship team. Unlike the person who slips in late to the sermon.
Or we measure our daily Bible reading against someone else's perceived lack of discipline. We use the spiritual failures of others as scaffolding to elevate our own status before God.
The tragedy of the Pharisee is that his focus was entirely horizontal. He was looking around the room at the tax collector, evaluating his resume against another human being, rather than looking vertically at the absolute holiness of God.
Which brings us to the other side of the courtyard.
Yes, let's go there.
Yeah.
If the cultural hero is operating on this transactional math equation, relying on a flawless extra credit resume, What does it look like when someone breaks the math completely?
It looks like the tax collector. Mm-hmm. And the contrast in their physical posture in the temple sets the stage for a massive theological shift.
Okay, paint the picture for us.
While the tax collector is standing far off, he won't even lift his eyes to heaven. He is beating his chest, which in Middle Eastern antiquity is a profound expression of agonizing grief.
He is devastated.
Totally devastated. And he prays a very short prayer. God, be merciful to me, a sinner.
Now, when you read that in English, it sounds like a simple plea for pity. It sounds like he's just saying, God, I messed up. Please let me off the hook.
Right. And that is exactly how modern readers interpret it, because the English word mercy usually implies leniency or, you know, just overlooking a fault.
Just letting it slide.
Yeah. But our sources point out a critical translation loss here. The tax collector does not use the standard Greek word for mercy, which is aleo.
Okay.
Instead, he uses a highly specific high priestly word, hilaskomai.
Hilaskomai. Okay. How does that change the meaning of his prayer?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, we have to remember the visceral reality of where they are standing. They are in the temple complex in Jerusalem. Based on the time of day people typically went to pray, it is highly likely that this scene is playing out during the Tamid.
Oh, let's unpack the Tamid for the listener, because understanding the sensory details of that environment seems super crucial.
It is. The Tamid was the daily sacrifice.
Oh.
Every morning and every evening, a spotless lamb was slaughtered on the brazen altar for the sins of the people. So picture the geography and the sensory overload of the temple courtyard. The tax collector is standing far off, likely in the outer court of the Gentiles, because his profession made him ceremonially unclean. He couldn't approach the inner courts.
Right. He's legally barred from getting close.
Exactly. He can hear the chanting of the Levites. He can smell the intense mixture of incense and burning meat. He is watching the thick black smoke of the sacrificed lamb rising up from the massive altar.
Okay, I have chills.
And in that moment, he uses the word hilaskomai, which means to make propitiation or to provide a blood atonement.
So he isn't asking God to just feel bad for him.
No. He's literally pointing his heart toward that smoking altar and praying, God, let the blood of that sacrifice be for me.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Because the difference between standard mercy and hilaskomai fundamentally alters how we understand grace today.
Oh, absolutely.
A lot of times, we treat God's mercy like a spiritual speeding ticket. You get pulled over, you roll down the window, and you say, Officer, have mercy on me. You are essentially asking the authority figure to just wink, ignore the infraction, and let you off with a warning.
Yeah, you are asking the judge to pretend the law doesn't exist.
Exactly. But hilaskomai operates on a completely different mechanism. To use a different analogy, it is more like a bank foreclosure.
Okay, I like this.
Standard mercy is asking the bank manager to just casually forget that you missed 20 mortgage payments and let you keep the house, which never happens.
Right.
But hilaskomai is acknowledging that the bank legally must take the house. The debt is real and devastating. Instead of asking them to ignore the ledger, you are begging for a mysterious benefactor to wire the exact funds required to actively clear the massive debt.
That is spot on.
The tax collector recognizes he has absolutely zero righteous works in his own pockets to pay the toll. He's saying, I have no resume to hand you, God. All I have is the smoke of that provided sacrifice.
That distinction is profound. The Pharisee points to his own hands, to the works he has accomplished.
Right, his mint leaves.
Right. But the tax collector points away from himself entirely to the provided sacrifice on the altar. And our research highlights another layer to this realization hidden in a microscopic grammatical detail in the original Greek text.
I love when the research zeroes in on a single word that changes the entire landscape of the story. What is the detail?
It comes down to a definite article. In almost all of our English Bibles, the tax collector's prayer is translated as, God be merciful to me, a sinner.
A sinner.
Yeah.
Like he is just one guy in a broad category of people who make mistakes.
Exactly. But in the Greek manuscript, the definite article ho is present. He doesn't say a sinner. He grammatically isolates himself and prays, God be propitiated to me, the sinner.
The sinner.
Singular.
A singular.
The psychological weight of that shift is staggering. It is. Think about the absolute contrast in their internal worlds. The Pharisee looked around the bustling temple courtyard, saw the tax collector, graded himself on a curve, and genuinely thought, I am the most righteous man in this room.
Right.
The tax collector looked around the exact same courtyard, surrounded by priests and worshipers, and genuinely believed he was the most broken, sinful man in the entire complex.
He has completely abandoned the comparison game.
Totally abandoned it.
He isn't looking at the Pharisee and thinking, well, at least I don't flaunt my religion like that guy.
Uh-huh.
He isn't looking at a Roman soldier and thinking, at least I'm not a pagan.
No, by using the definite article, by declaring himself the sinner, he completely bypasses horizontal human comparison.
Yeah.
He measures his own heart strictly against the vertical, absolute holiness of God.
And when you do that, when you stop grading your sin on a curve against your neighbor, you realize you aren't just one flawed person in the crowd.
No, you're not.
Standing before a holy God, you are the sinner in desperate need of a covering.
And that is incredibly confronting for the modern church experience.
Oh, for sure. We are so conditioned to seek safety in numbers. We instinctively try to find someone whose sin looks messier or more public than our own, just to give ourselves a false sense of security.
Yeah, but the tax collector's posture, that total abandonment of the spiritual resume and the complete reliance on the substitutionary sacrifice that leads to the climax of the story.
And this climax completely shattered the first century religious paradigm, didn't it? Just as it challenges ours today.
It did. Jesus concludes the story with a verdict. He tells the crowd that it was the tax collector, the traitor, the extortionist, the man with absolutely no resume who went down to his house justified rather than the Pharisee.
The word justified carries a lot of theological baggage today. Let's unpack the mechanism of that word. The sources note the Greek term is dikaiou. What did that actually mean in a first century context?
Well, dikaiou is a strict legal term rooted in first century jurisprudence. It is vital to understand that it does not merely mean forgiven.
Okay, what's the difference?
A pardon in a courtroom implies that you are guilty, but the judge has decided not to punish you. Your record still shows the crime. Dikaiou is entirely different. It means to be declared righteous by a judge.
Oh, wow.
It is the judge banging the gavel and declaring that, legally speaking, your standing before the court is completely flawless.
So the narrative whiplash for the audience listening to Jesus is absolute.
Oh, they would have been reeling.
The man with the perfect religious resume, the cultural hero who fasted 104 times a year and painstakingly tithed the mint leaves from his garden, goes home completely unjustified. His resume means nothing.
Nothing at all.
But the man who collaborated with the enemy, who brought zero spiritual extra credit to the table, goes home with a legal declaration of total righteousness before God.
Yes. Because in this one masterful story, Jesus established that justification before God cannot be purchased, negotiated, or earned by a flawless religious resume.
Right.
It is granted purely through God's grace to those who recognize their total spiritual bankruptcy and rely entirely on his provision.
Okay, so what does this all mean? For you, listening right now, walking out your faith in the complexity of the modern world.
Yeah, how does this apply?
It means the gospel is fundamentally opposed to the project of becoming the Pharisee. Your faith journey isn't about perfectly managing your outward behavior so you can stand in your community and subtly reduce everyone else to a zero.
Exactly.
It is about the deeply humbling recognition that your resume, no matter how disciplined or shiny, will never be enough to purchase the favor of a holy God.
And, you know, if we truly internalize that reality, it shouldn't produce guilt. It should produce profound freedom.
I love that. Freedom.
It leaves us with a really provocative thought to mull over as we close out this deep dive today.
Mm-hmm.
The tax collector walked away completely justified simply by recognizing his spiritual bankruptcy and pointing to the provided sacrifice.
Yeah.
How much of our own modern religious exhaustion comes from us secretly trying to hand God our extra credit?
Man, that is a question. Are you burning yourself out, striving to be good enough so that God owes you a blessing? When you bow your head to pray, whether in a church pew or in your car on the way to work, are you praying to be noticed for your discipline? Or are you praying to be covered by the sacrifice?
That question completely reorients the landscape of our hearts.
It really does. It dismantles those neat little boxes of the good guy and the bad guy, reminding us that without grace, we are all just desperate people in need of a savior.
Absolutely beautifully said.
Thank you so much for joining us as we explored these sources today. We encourage you to carry this new perspective and the freedom to drop the resume into your daily walk this week. Until next time.